get started. Quiet, please. The topic for today's lecture is economics. There's a whole subdiscipline of anthropology devoted to the study of economic systems around the world, and that is called, not surprisingly, economic anthropology. So today's an introduction to some of the main issues as they've been laid out in your text, and there's a lot of information there, so I'm going to walk you through it, make sure that you get the main points. Economic anthropology is defined in the text as the part of the discipline that debates issues of human nature that relate directly to the decisions of daily life and making a living. This idea of making a living will come up again and again today, and we'll think about what that means to make a living. When we say make a living, we're generally talking about what it requires for us to, get our subsistence needs taken care of. Subsistence being your basic needs, clothing, food, shelter. And so anthropologists use the phrase subsistence strategies for talking about the different ways humans have come up with in terms of how to acquire those things that they need, that we need. So different subsistence strategies have already been introduced to you. We've seen a film, and we've read a lot about foraging bands, bands being the social organization form, foraging meaning the actual economic activity going on. We've also had some introduction to agriculture. Remember the slides that Professor Kotak showed us from Madagascar, and how rice agriculture uses a form of technology called terracing. So agriculture is another means of acquiring subsistence needs. Another one would be pastoralism, and we'll talk about that more today in depth. Last week, we also heard about the Maasai group in East Africa, and many of you have probably seen Maasai in ads, in commercials. There was a famous Olympics ad and some Nike commercial that showed Maasai. And Maasai are nomadic herders. Pastoralism requires taking care of domesticated animals. And there can be different varieties of that. You can take care of camels, you can take care of cattle, you can take care of sheep, goats, any variety of things. So starting, another mode, one that we live in, is industrialism, and I'll talk more about that on Thursday. So that's one of the ways in which we acquire our subsistence needs. So let's start briefly by going over the three that I've mentioned. Three of the four. Foraging. As we've talked about already, this is primarily hunting and gathering, acquiring your needs pretty directly from nature. So going out, finding the food you need, hunting it, gathering it. And the people in Australia that we saw, they are an example of that. People in Southern Africa, people in the rainforests of Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo and Central Africa. These are areas of the world where you find foraging still in existence. However, due to vast changes that have gone on in our world, it's very untenable these days to pursue an exclusively foraging subsistence strategy. So most foragers now, in some way or another, are involved either in food production or trade in order to acquire the things that they need. And the reasons for that, oftentimes, are that governments are instituting policies that restrict the movement of foragers. If you think about it from a government's perspective, it's very hard for you to have communities within your boundaries that want to move all the time and move and have access to all sorts of land. And when you have increasing population pressures and this and that, governments find this very problematic. And so they institute land policies that restrict, that create reservations, that restrict the movement of indigenous groups that would like to use foraging as their main mode of subsistence. So because of some of these pressures from government policy and increasing encroachment on their land through other agriculturalists and people next to them, you find that foragers cannot be exclusively reliant on foraging, very few today. In the book, foragers are also mentioned by reference to a very famous anthropologist named Marshall Solins. Marshall Solins has written a lot about economic anthropology, and he sort of debunked the idea that foragers are the poorest of the poor, that no one would dare want to be a forager because you're constantly scrounging about trying to get the basics that you need. And drawing on the data that Richard Lee starts out with in that chapter for the reading for today, Richard Lee shows just how much food is actually acquired in a very short period of time. And so that, in fact, by their own standards, a lot of foraging communities at the time that Richard Lee was doing his research, mind you, in the 1960s, that they were extremely affluent because they had more than what they needed and more than what they wanted. Therefore, Marshall Salas took this to understand that they are the original affluent society because they have everything they need in abundance, so that we should not look down on them as being so wholly different and so wholly impoverished in relation to the capitalist, very wealthy West. Agriculture is a widespread subsistence strategy that we have in our society as well. I should emphasize that you can have multiple subsistence strategies within a society. One may be more dominant than the others, and it's generally the case, but you can have more than one in one community. So, as I just said, the foragers are now mixing foraging, hunting, and gathering with some basic food production sometimes, with trade. So in our society, we mix a bunch of different strategies together. So agriculture is one. You can have very different approaches to agriculture. One type of agriculture, sometimes called horticulture, is known as shifting cultivation. That means that you have a community that will farm some land for a period of time. But after time, the soil becomes depleted of whatever it is, of the resources needed, nutrients needed for that particular crop. So what will happen is that after a period of time, people will leave that plot alone and move on and start another plot with the same crop. And then they're just moving around, shifting cultivation. These are called swittens because you burn the ground to create a clearing that is used temporarily for agricultural purposes. Now that's different from intensive agriculture, wherein the same plot of land is used over and over and over again. So we have large-scale agriculture here, where families have been living on the same farm for decades, and what you have to do in order to maintain the quality of the soil is to use technologies of various kinds to make sure that you're continually rejuvenating the soil. So fertilizers would be one means. In Madagascar, the rice terraces are ways of creating a continual rich soil with the use of water and mud. And so there are different ways in which, also intercropping, I think I put that up there, intercropping is a strategy used in parts of the world and parts of Africa where I've worked, where you will plant different crops within the same field, so that you might have beans, and then in between the beans you would have yams. And the reason being is that they would draw different nutrients from the soil and give back different things. So that is a way of maintaining the health of your soil. So there are different strategies that people have come up with for dealing with intensive permanent agriculture, which is different from the shifting cultivation that I described previously. Well, the third form that I mentioned is pastoralism. And this is the example I'm going to draw today are the Maasai-speaking communities of East Africa. The Maasai are not the only people who speak the Maa language. There are these four other groups, the Samburu, the Arial, the Lachamus, and the Luparakuyu, who also speak Maa languages. And there's slight variance in the dialects of the same language. But they're mutually intelligible, so Samburu can go to the Maasai community and speak with people and be understood, and similarly be understood by them. So the Maasai speakers, first of all, pastoralism, as I said, is having nomadic peoples who move with their animals and are free to follow their animals to better grazing areas or water sources. And so they're very mobile, like the foragers. And their whole life is oriented around whatever animal it is that they, or groups of animals that they take care of. So animal husbandry is what designates pastoralism as another subsistence strategy. So the mosque speakers, as you can see, this is a map of Kenya, and then down below is Tanzania. And the Ma are the Arial, you see them in the middle, Samburu. The Arial, the Samburu, Maasai, you see Maasai come all the way down into Tanzania. And these are the communities that speak the Ma language, so it's spread over a wide area. Now, as I said, you've probably seen pictures of Maasai, this being one that appears, can you see that? In some local magazines, it's current, I just took it out about a month ago. And the Maasai are famous, they're sort of the iconic representative of Noble Savage. I'll talk about that in a little bit. So like foragers, pastoralists are under considerable pressures, both from governments and from neighboring groups, because of the need they have to continually move. And this is problematic if you're a farmer nearby and you don't necessarily want a group of Maasai coming through with their cattle to trample your fields. You can see how that would create a conflict of interest in terms of how land is used and allocated. Nation states are also are concerned with boundaries and who are their citizens. So if you have, as I showed you on the map, the Maasai straddle, they are found both in Kenya and Tanzania. When the nation-state boundaries were determined, nobody paid any mind to who lives where. So the boundary cut through Maasai territory. As a result, you have Maasai in Kenya and in Tanzania who consider themselves part of the same group, and they feel that they have the right to go back and forth as they always have for years and years and years. And so the creation of this, essentially in their minds, artificial boundary that they have to have a paper in order to cross is another conflict of interest between state and Maasai groups. So policing of boundaries, these are some of the pressures that they face today. Another pressure is the creation of national parks. I would venture to say that there are two images that are dominant in our media about Africa. And one is of starving, malnourished, war-ridden human communities, very negative portrayals of humans. We're seeing a lot of that in terms of the Mozambique crisis. It's true, but it's just the dominant of it in the media. And secondly, beautiful, positive images of animals, so that you want to go on safari and this and that. So these are the two images that come out of Africa. So the creation of national parks to feed this Western desire to be able to go to beautiful places and see animals like giraffes and lions in their natural habitat is something else that is a relatively recent development, and that has also entailed another pressure placed on Maasai communities, because that's exactly where they live. And so when governments go in, they want to cordon off an area and say, this is only for the use, exclusive use of tourists. Then, of course, that eats away again at traditional grazing areas that the Maasai have always used. So that's yet another pressure. A third is the creation of commercial ranches. The government has decided that there is indeed profit to be had from raising cattle. And so, but the problem is the Maasai don't necessarily want to do all the things that the government wants them to do. So all the sort of the medicines that the government would have you give to your cattle to ensure whatever, you know, good growth and quality of beef, these are not things that the Maasai are terribly interested in terms of technological investment in their cattle. They have different ideas that have worked for them for centuries on how to raise cattle. So they don't necessarily want these problems from the government as they see them. So commercial ranches, so now the government has decided to create an environment where people are invited to invest and create big, large-scale ranches for the keeping of cattle. And that will follow the government's guidelines in terms of vaccinations and this and that and the other. So again, now you have commercial ranches competing for the same land that the Maasai have always used. And then finally, large-scale agriculture. There are new developments in terms of the creation of large-scale wheat farms and coffee plantations and all sorts of things that, again, are another threat to Maasai grazing areas. So between all of this, the Maasai are having a difficult time trying to be able to maintain their pastoral way of life because there's all this encroachment on the land that they need to follow their cattle around. And mind you, Africa is a very difficult environment to live in. I'm going to show you some pictures of it. But it's very arid, this area of Kenya that was on the map. Very arid and dry, and there's a rainy season and a dry season, so you have to move in accordance with the seasons. When it's a dry season, you have to go to the few areas that you know of where there's a constant supply of water. And during the rainy season, you have more opportunities to go elsewhere and take advantage of different grazing areas. So because of the environment, they have to have that mobility, and that mobility is increasingly infringed upon by these different factors. Now, Maasai have also a problem dealing with the issue of land, because they don't conceive of land as being owned individually. So when the government gives plots, tracts of land to commercial ranchers or to large-scale agriculturalists, for Maasai, you can own cattle individually. A person can identify a cow that belongs to him or her. But the idea of land as being owned by a person is somewhat foreign. And so that's another conflict, because they think that how can you own this land? This is something we've been using for decades. And who are you to say that we cannot have access to this water hole that we've always taken our cattle to since my grandfather, his grandfather, etc.? So the idea of land as being owned individually is problematic, because they don't have land, a conception of private ownership of land. They do have it for cattle. It's not that they don't know what private ownership is, but they just don't apply that principle to the ownership of land. So they therefore are not terribly respectful of the idea of other people owning land. So that's another problem. Now, Professor Kotak told you that Maasai have these named age sets, and they occur for about a 7-year period. Just as the example of taking class of whatever, you are moving through a 4-year span of time with your age set. Maasai groups and Samburu and Ariel and all the neighbor communities that engage in this have 7-year span groups. So any boy that is born within the same 7-year period of time will be a member of that age set, and we'll go through circumcision together. So it's not that they're all age 13. I mean, they can range from, whatever, 9 to 16, and they'll be in an age set, and they'll all undergo circumcision together. And these are very intense groupings, sodalities, because they live together. They more than as close, if not more so, than sibling relationships in America. Because this is the progression. Male age grades begin as a boy, and then once you're circumcised, you are initiated, and you are called a moran. The plural form of that is morani. Okay? And so once you become a warrior, you are sent out with the cattle, and you live away from your parents and away from the community, and you all live together out in the bush, and you're following the cattle around while people stay back at home. And so because of that intense isolation and bonding that goes on, these people see themselves as a community for the rest of their lives. And they have a name attached to their group. After being a moran, they then graduate to being a junior elder, at which point they can marry. And then after a period of being a junior elder, they then ultimately become a senior elder. So these are the four stages through which, the four age grades that at any given age set will pass through. Women pass through a different set. They start as young girls, are then thought of as adolescent girls, where they are marriageable age, at which point, once they get married, then they are a married woman, and then the giving of birth catapults them into the most honored, esteemed status, which is that of mother, and that's the highest status for them. They're also thought of as elders, but it's not a formalized thing as it is for them. With all these pressures from government policy, etc., the same communities in this area are all suffering under the same pressures. So Baran are a foraging community. Randili, Arya, Samburu, these are all nomadic pastoralists. Gabra, I think, are another foraging community. Turkana are also nomads. So all these communities, which traditionally have been unfettered in their movements, now are having to negotiate all these problems with branches and government policies, etc. So because of all these increasing pressures on them from outside external forces, it has led to an increase of conflict from within, so that they are now competing with each other for the scarce access to land that's not available. So there's an increase now of also conflict between these communities. As I said, that you often see them Maasai used in advertisements and in Hollywood films, and that's because they represent for people the Africa that people think of as lost. Because when you're just getting this barrage of negative human misery coming out of Africa, you want to look to something and cling to something that's somehow noble and above all that. Somebody just wrote to me yesterday from South Africa about the efforts going on in Mozambique. And for every helicopter that has been sent over as aid to pick up people, pluck people from the water, and I'm sure you've seen some of the pictures of that, for every helicopter that's there plucking people out of the water, there are two helicopters of journalists. And how many people did any of those helicopters pluck? Not a one. So this emphasis on capturing the misery and capturing and spreading it around the world is overwhelming with regard to Africa. So the one sort of refuge away from that misery is to have a picture, something to look up to as noble and honorable. And so, but in the process, the image gets corrupted somewhat. And so we're going to see that right now. Excuse me. Okay. Just give an example. Anyway, I have a lot of problems with this film for a variety of reasons, and it was not presented to me in the manner in which it eventually emerged, else I would not have gotten involved. But that scene is very illuminating of how Hollywood distorts images. And I won't get back to economic anthropology, but just for this ties into our discussion on Thursday too of world systems and how the rest is involved with quote unquote the rest. But that scene was the first scene where the Samburu, and this is Samburu, although in the script it's called for Maasai, and you heard them afterwards refer to them as Maasai, they are in fact Samburu. They would take umbrage at the idea that they were being presented as Maasai. I don't think they've seen the film. But anyway, they are Samburu. And they were flown in because Hollywood had a contact with Samburu, did not have a contact with Maasai. There was another film called The Arab There, some of you may have seen, which had a Samburu community in it. And so because they knew these people, they said, hey, we'll take advantage of them again, close enough, almost like a Maasai. So brought them in, and I was asked to talk to Michael Douglas about this scene, because he had this vision in his mind of what he wanted this scene to be when he arrives. It's his arrival scene, and it's their arrival scene as well. And so he sat down and he said, okay, look, Kelly, I want this thing. I want to say something. And then they all call some battle cry response. And then they jump out of the grass. So I'm like, well, you know, why don't I talk to them and see if they have such a thing as a quote unquote battle cry? I mean, you can see the references to Westerns, right? What was this? It's like how when they come up out of the grass. I mean, some of the cliched lines and stuff. I won't go into that. But he wanted to scream something out, and then there would be this response. And so I talked to them and I said, well, you guys, what would you say? Is there such a thing as a call and response thing that might go on here? And we thought and thought and thought, well, what about we are Moran? What if he just calls us warriors, you know, which is what we are? And almost all of those young men were indeed from the Moran age grade. So he does that. He says, Warani, which is the plural form of Moran. And they said, okay, that's good, and we've got that covered, but what would we respond? And they thought, and finally one person said, well, you know, if someone calls you and you're startled by that, you would say, boo. And so, what if we just did that? Like, we're sort of surprised that he called us. And so I was like, well, I don't know, okay, let's try that. So we go on to set. And they had kept the Samburu away, like at a 20-mile distance from anyone else on the cast and crew. And we were kept, like, I was with them because I was the interpreter. And we were kept segregated, and I didn't realize really quite why that was until we shot the scene, which is the first scene. And what struck me was that the cameras were not oriented, the first setup of the cameras was not on the Maasai, Samburu, but in fact on everybody else. And what I realized afterwards was we were being kept apart because they wanted to capture as true as possible a sense of shock and amazement at the exotic Samburu on everyone else's faces. So Val Kilmer and all the people in the crowd were supposed to be totally shocked by the sight of us, because it would be truly, indeed, the very first time that they would see any of the Samburu. And so the orientation of the cameras was a big clue. So anyway, so they shot the scene several times. He calls Warani, they jump up out of the grass, they ran forward, they stood in a line, and then they said, woo, in unison. And so you could see Michael Douglas wasn't quite satisfied with that. He sat and talked with the director, and they thought, like, well, what if you sustained that? What if you kept going with it for a little bit? Can we try that? So everyone gets back in the grass, they crouch down, the director calls action, whatever, and they come running up forward, and you saw in the line, they start doing this again. Woo, woo, woo. What would you feel like if we were to cough extendedly, or hiccup extendedly, or something? This is not what they do. Completely concocted. Anyway, more on that later. But what I want to do is show you images of what their life really truly is like. And I wish that I had these on slides, because I think it would do better justice to them, but you'll just have to suffer with it. Come back here for a second to show you the area that I'm talking about. Samburu area is here, and Mar-a-Lago is the main center where Samburu come to trade and to buy the few things that they need from stores and stuff like that. So downtown Mar-a-Lago looks like this. You can see the brightly colored shops. There will be a mixture of people because it's a trading post. So not only Samburu, but people from all over who come and open up shops, you can see the imbrication and the coming together of different subsistence strategies. So within Maranello, you have the pastoralist Samburu, but you also have shopkeepers who are engaged in market exchange. Just a close up, you can see some of the tins that are hanging from the rooftop there. If ever you wondered, yes, there is a Hard Rock Cafe. You can't see that very well, but it does indeed say Hard Rock Cafe. These are some cloth vendors. Now, in the pictures that you see of Samburu and Maasai, they have very strict color combinations of what they will and will not wear. And men are wearing a lot of red, women wear a lot of blue. So start picking that out as you see them. That's not very clear. Here you can see a Samburu woman who's now, because of the problems with pastoralism, starting to engage in other activities. When these Samburu came down for the film, they were actually selling their beadworks because they realized a lot of Westerners were really into that. So you know, they know how to exploit the market as well. So coming out of Maranello now, you see the arid environment in which they actually do their herding. And it's a very challenging environment. It's extremely, extremely dry at times. This is called an acacia tree, which is no movie about Africa can be without an acacia tree. And here we're going into an area that is a little bit more lush. Now the Rendili, who are a neighbor group, they herd camels in addition to goats, in addition to cattle. They've decided that it's better to diversify your basket, don't put all your eggs in one basket. So they have camels and different things because if a certain disease were to hit one of their animals, then they still have the other ones. Maasai are pretty much exclusively into cows. Samburu will mix cows and goats, but they don't deal with camels. So it's another one of the differences between these groups, what exactly they domesticate. So you can see here, Rendili child herding his camel. And here's a Samburu child herding some goats. Now I'm going to show you some house structures. This is a Barani hut. The Barani, again, are more foraging people. And so what you notice about this is that their kraal is really that sort of very sort of not terribly involved fencing because they're going to pick up and move not long afterwards. Their houses are made of grass. It's very easy to take apart and very easy to construct. Samburu are more settled than that. They move, but generally what happens is that the elders will stay in a given homestead, and the young boys, the Morans, the warriors will take the cattle and move around with the cattle. But you do have the elderly people, the women, and the children staying primarily in a kraal. And kraal is their homestead, the area in which they keep their goats when the people come back from having gone around grazing. Homestead. You can see the construction, it's much more detailed and involved than the Barani. It's a woman gathering wood. Now you see, these are Morans. And they're identifiable because they always walk around with three weapons. They must have a spear, they must have a knife that is tied around their waist, and they have a walking stick, which they call a rumbu, which is generally under one arm. So when they come to visit somebody, they'll put the spears in the ground and they'll start socializing that way. Now this is the cattle market. I was with these guys after the film and helped to accompany them back home and pay them. And so first thing they did with their money was to go to a cattle auction and buy more cows for their families. Cows is how they have their wealth. That's how they measure wealth. And whereas we, you know, consider money our staple form of wealth, and you accrue it in your bank account, cows are like their bank account. The more cows you have, the more security you have against hardship down the line. So here are people sitting around looking at the cows that are for sale and trying to decide which one they want to bid on. The beadwork is another identifying factor that distinguishes one group from another. The color combinations they use in their beads. There's a distinctly Samburu beadwork pattern that's different from the Maasai, it's different from Rendili. So they can tell by looking at that which community you're from. Now just the fact that there's an auction shows that again there's some market exchange going on. And school has been introduced, and so Samburu youths are now going to school, just like most other children in Kenya. And you can see the beadwork on women. Women accumulate these beads all through their lives, and they never take them off. The idea is that they'll never take them off. And so it gets increasingly bigger at two points in your life. When you're older, if you've been around for quite a while, and when you're about to get married, is when you'll be given a lot of beads by your older female relatives. So when you get to this age, then you start giving away your beads to the young girls who are about to get married. This was one of our actors. Come back home. Not the one that you would see depicted in any sort of film. And I want to get back to the idea of making a living, because some anthropologists have drawn it, one anthropologist, Brackett Williams, has talked about the difference between making a living and making life. And what does she mean by that? So she's doing her research in a community in Guyana, in Central America. And she talks about how different groups talk about each other in these terms. So for instance, Indian shopkeepers, who are the people who have started most of the shops in this community, they are talked about as being very, very good at making a living, but not terribly good at making life. And what that is, from the outside, it looks for people who are not as devoted to shopkeeping and all the work that entails, people say they work all the time. They're just working all the time. And so they don't have time to actually live life. They're too busy making a living. And so she draws that distinction that making a living is defined as a person's industry, skill, and ambition, all of which result in material rewards, the things that one acquires. Whereas making life is your interest in the socioeconomic well-being of others as well as your own. So that some people place more emphasis on one rather than the other. And the ideal is that you should be able to balance them. We'll come back to that. So, in the book, they identify that there are, what's often talked about in the literature, three phases of economic activity: production, distribution, and consumption. And I wish that I had a better computer record. Actually, it's kind of a circle, because what people consume feeds back into the production. And actually, it's more complicated than that. You have to draw lines back and forth between the distribution, how things are distributed, may increase consumption or decrease consumption, as opposed to, you know, it's much more complicated than just a simple production, distribution, consumption, linear progression. The production means the transformation of raw materials taken out of nature. and creating products that we find useful. Distribution is the allocation of goods and services. And the consumption is the use of goods and services. Oftentimes, the definition ends there. But the book is making a point that you can't just end it there. And so they continue the definition to say consumption is not only the use of goods and services for human survival, but as well as to communicate human cultural values. Because we have to start accounting for the differences that come up. Why in that same region of Kenya are there pastoralists and foragers and agriculturalists and shopkeepers? You can't say that it's just for human survival. I mean, if there was just one way of surviving, then we'd all be doing pretty much the same thing. But there, we've all found different ways, and we value those different ways, and they have meaning for us. So what is it about consumption that also talks about culture, cultural values? Anthropological theories have tended to focus one of these over the other. And I'm going to go through those that after you have your break. So stand up and stretch for 3 minutes, and we'll come back to the different types of theory.
Did you make those slides in French?
Distributing things. So For a period of time, exchange theory was what dominated early economic anthropology, because it was theorized in response to what was then the dominant economic model, which is neoclassical economic theory, as emblemized by Adam Smith. And the book goes into that, what neoclassical economic theory is, its emphasis on the free market as the motor of capitalism, that it's free because there are no traditional restrictions determining how things are distributed. In previous times, you know, only nobles could get certain things, and something there were restrictions on how things could be distributed. Now the free market is free because those restrictions supposedly don't exist. That prices fluctuate in response to the laws of supply and demand. That the market determines levels of production and consumption. All this should be familiar to you. And capitalism is the only form of economic rationality. Well, the logical extension of that, of course, is that non-capitalist societies are irrational, and that is something that we do not accept. So in trying to come up with a response to this dominant paradigm, anthropologists came up with the idea of exchange theory. And they were called substantivists. They were responding to people called formalists. There were some people within anthropology who did find that neoclassical economic theory was applicable to non-capitalist societies, but substantivists rejected that claim and saying that it's not applicable. You have to understand each society's economic system on its own basis. And so they say that there's more than one possible economic rationality, that contrary to capitalist thought, everything does not have a price and is not for sale, that the self-interested materialism of Western capitalism is not universal, and that trying to force non-Western economies into these Western models, irrespective of fit, is doomed to failure, because you're imposing this. Moreover, they point out that the capitalist market is a relatively recent invention in the history of humanity, and that it is not the only mode of exchange. So that non-capitalist societies have alternate modes of exchange, and they do distribute goods in accordance with their cultural values. So the book goes into some examples of what these kinds of exchange are. In broad sweeping, to paint it sweeping terms, you can think about it this way, that in the West, wealth is measured by how much we consume. The house you live in, the car you drive, the clothes you wear, the number of CDs you have in your collection, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the marker of how wealthy someone is, how much you can consume. But in other parts of the world, as in Africa and in the Northwest Coast, wealth is seen by how much you give away. That the true mark of a wealthy man is that he can give tons of money away, gifts, you know, he can constantly give things away. So it's not the consumption, but the distribution that is the marker of wealth. So Marshall Solomons identified three modes of exchange. In saying that there's an alternative to the West, he came up with some alternatives. So these are reciprocity, redistribution, and market exchange, being what the West is famous for. So there are three kinds of reciprocity, according to Marshall Solomons. And these are generalized reciprocity, which is where you give something with no expectation that it will be returned immediately, anytime soon. Secondly, there's balanced reciprocity. And the example in the book was of Christmas time, when you give gifts, but you also expect to receive gifts. So that's balanced. When there's an equal exchange, when an exchange is made with the expectation that there will be a return to you within a prescribed period of time. So that's called balanced reciprocity. The third one is negative reciprocity, the attempt to get something for nothing. So haggling at the market, theft if you want to go that far. That's called negative reciprocity. Redistribution is the second mode of exchange, and that is where a central organization or a central person, and the example was the IRS as an organization, the example of a person in the chiefdom of the chief, who accepts contributions from everybody in the society and then redistributes it according to the needs of everyone in society. So redistribution is another form of exchange. So as you can see, these two, reciprocity and redistribution, are not in keeping with the capitalist mode. I mean, there's no prices involved. All the things that go on with market exchange do not apply. So the potlatch is something that occurs in the northwest coast of North America. And that's a very famous example that anthropologists have used to talk about redistribution as a mode of exchange. Because that's where some noble in these Native American communities will take a lot of wealth and just give it away, or burn it, you know, just get rid of it. But a lot of it is giving it away. And so that's seen as irrational, or like that he's not getting any profit from this. Why would someone do that? Why would they take all their wealth and just give it all away? But that's because, in part, people who are confused by that are seeing wealth and profit in singularly material terms. So that if wealth is only the things that you have, then it's hard for you to understand how you can still be wealthy after you've given all that stuff away. But in other societies, wealth is measured by many different things. So you can get prestige. You can raise your status in society by having done that, which is worth more than the things, the dishes and the pots and everything else that you've just given away and distributed to everybody. So a potlatch is an example, a very famous example of redistribution. Another example would be rotating credit associations. These are found all over the world, and that's where particularly strong in women's groups, and my experience again in Africa, has led me to see how these things work. A rotating credit association is where a group of women will get together. And mind you, you know, life is hard, and so your daily needs, your daily income, whatever you do, generally just about covers what your daily needs are. There's often not a lot of surplus there. So when a big expense comes along, like you need a new roof, or your child needs the school fees to be paid, something big, or you have somebody who's getting married and you know that that's going to be a major expenditure. So when something big comes along, that often cripples the little person, but somebody who doesn't have access to a lot of wealth. So what rotating credit associations do is that you get together with a group of your friends, people who you trust, and everyone puts in a certain amount of money every month. And one person gets to walk away every month with the whole lump sum. And you'll plan it out. Like as you get together, a woman will say, well, you know, in October, I'm going to need to pay my son's school fees. And another woman will say, well, and in November, my daughter's getting married. So it will be planned so that everyone benefits from getting a big lump sum of money that they wouldn't be able to build themselves on a daily basis. So that's another way of distributing funds. In East Africa, you have these things called dance societies as well, where purportedly the idea was people get together and enjoy life, and this is a form of entertainment, getting together and dancing and performing at weddings and stuff like that. But another thing, those societies served as self-help organizations too. People would come together and help out, contribute their labor, and contribute money and gifts for big events, so funerals and weddings being the primary too. So that if you had such an event in your family, you could depend on your dance society to come in and show up on these required day and be there to help cook, be there with all the extra plates you're going to need to distribute the food, and be there to contribute money for all the other additional costs that are entailed. So dance societies also serve this function for redistributing wealth. And I put here secret societies with a question mark in America because we have such things. And it's a way of maybe not distributing money so much as distributing contacts, getting knowledge out about different people and leads in to jobs and stuff like that. That can be seen as a redistribution as well, distribution of knowledge and services and contacts. Market exchange, then, is the final form of exchange that is discussed in the book. And Carl Pugliani is most famous for being associated with that. He defined capitalism as an exchange of goods, so trade, calculated in terms of a multi-purpose medium of exchange and standard of value, i.e. money, and carried on by means of the supply-demand price mechanism, i.e. the market. So these are the defining features of capitalism. And as I said before, different modes of exchange can coexist in a single society, but one generally serves as its primary mode of operation, so that when we say capitalist West or capitalist America, we know that other things occur. There are gifts. We give gifts to each other. We have reciprocity, too. We also redistribute. We have that, too. But the dominant mode that drives our economy as a nation is the market, and so therefore we are considered a capitalist society. Other societies will lend weight to something else. So in the rural community I showed you, you see people are involved in trade. There might be some agriculture there too. I haven't seen it in Sambura, but you know, there's different ways of you combine strategies to get by. Now the second, so if we've done distribution, the middle point in that equation, we move backward now, and the next thing that came to be very popular in anthropology was production theory. And this was generated as a result of interest in the writings of Karl Marx, who should be familiar to you. Now Marx is very famous for having recognized and placed importance and emphasized a human labor. So that piece of paper that I'm holding up is composed of pulp from wood. But if you just see it, if you just attach its value to the value of the wood, you'd be off, because what made it into paper is not the wood, but so much as the labor involved in taking the wood and mashing it up and treating it with chemicals, etc., and pressing it. All that labor involved that resulted in these pieces of paper. So the labor is what transforms the natural resources, the raw materials, and takes them and creates products out of them. And the labor is often ignored when people are attaching prices to things. They look at the components of something. And so that's why he's seen as very revolutionary for emphasizing that we need to take account of the human labor involved in production. He also focused on how labor links human groups. It's not a singular individual activity. It's something that we do together, and not only links us to each other, but it links us to the material world, because that's what we're dealing with. We're taking these things from the world around us and transforming them. So that labor is this thing that can create solidarities. Sometimes get bogged down in the terminology associated with Marx's thought. So the way to think about it is that he talks about the means of production. The means of production are the things you need to do the production, the act of production. So in the case of paper, you need your wood, you need your machine to cut down wood, you need the chemicals involved in treating the wood, you need the pressers to press it into paper. All those things are the means of production. And the knowledge, including the knowledge that goes into knowing how to transform wood into paper. So it's the tools, the skills, the organization, and the knowledge used to extract energy from nature. In addition to that, you have the relations of production. Now, I said labor links people together and creates social groupings. So what are the relationships between groups that link people either to the natural materials or to each other or to the tools and the means of production? What are the relationships between all the people in this process? So if you take the means of production in conjunction with the relations of production, the sum total is what you will see as the mode of production for a given community. And that, as defined by Eric Wolf, is a specific, historically occurring set of social relations through which labor is deployed to wrest energy from nature by means of tools, skills, organizations, and knowledge. So you see in his definition, he says, the social relations combined with the means of production. So that's what Karl Marx is having been able to break down economic relations into these different components. Now Marx theorized at least eight different forms of modes of production. I'm not going to look at all eight here. I'm just going to talk about four. One of them is the kin order mode of production. The kin order mode of production is where labor is deployed on the basis of kinship relations. So for instance, foragers. We saw that the bands are generally bands composed of family members, so that people have prescribed tasks within the band as to what they're going to do, so the economic duties they're going to do. So that's an example of a kin-ordered mode of production. Another one would be peasant farmers. If you think of the family farm, where everyone on the farm, again, is assigned specific tasks. So that would be another example of a kin-ordered mode of production. Now, tributary mode of production is where the producer is allowed access to the means of production, but required to give tribute in exchange. Let me give you an example of that. Think of feudal times. There would be a feudal lord. He'd have peasants working on his land. Those peasants could produce for themselves as well. They had access to the means of production. The means, in that case, being the land, the seed, whatever tools they needed. So they had access to the means of production, but they had to pay a certain amount of it back to somebody else. So they had to give tribute. Okay? Another example would be chiefdoms, where you have that. Those people give bring tribute. They'll harvest their own plots of land, they'll have their plots of land, but then at the end of the harvest, they'll come and they'll give a certain portion of that over to the chief, who will store it for times of need for everybody else. So that's where the redistribution comes in. People bring in, they give tribute to the chief stores it in times of need, he pulls out the extra stores of food, and he can distribute that. So the tributary mode of production is another variety. The capitalist mode of production is where, you know, Marx has done a lot of work, and it has three defining features. First of all, the means of production are owned by the capitalist. So that in a factory, if you give him as an example, the factory is owned by somebody who would then be called, in Marxist terms, the capitalist. Workers do not own the means of production, and they must sell their labor to the capitalist in order to survive. So they are disenfranchised from the means of production. Factory workers don't own any share in that, so that they're selling their labor. The company is buying their labor. And finally, that workers' labor translates into profits, a surplus of wealth for the capitalist. So Marx analyzed this whole set of relationships, if you look at the social relationships between the capitalist and the workers, and the means of production owned by the capitalist and not the workers, that together, those sets of constraints means that you have a capitalist mode production. And then Marx theorized the creation of an ideal form in his mind of mode of production would be the socialist mode, wherein everybody in society would own all the means of production. And that would be the ideal. We know from history that several communities and nations tried to do that and not succeeded. But in his theory, that would be ideal. If everyone could own the means of production, that would be a truly egalitarian system. So what we see is that there's a shift now from focus on exchange to focus on production. And this shift in focus generated another sort of antecedent shifts in terms of anthropological economic thought. And that is that whereas before, looking at exchange theory, there was more of an emphasis on exchange and equality and social equilibrium, how the system maintains itself, that there's one person may accrue an enormous amount of wealth, but then it reaches this level where it's just too much, and so then he has to give it all away, and so that brings everything back to zero again, and it builds up again, and the system just keeps working over and over to maintain this sense of equilibrium. Well, Marx, by talking about production and the inequality inherent to certain types of mode of production, shifted the focus, and so now we think in terms of not so much equilibrium, but social change, and the dynamics and conflict, how different communities, because of their relationship, their unequal relationship, or their differing positions in the mode of production, therefore come into conflict with each other. They have different interests. So these different interests often are related to or supported by different ideologies that come about. And Marx defined ideology as the products of consciousness, such as morality, religion, metaphysics, that explain to people who they are and justify to them the kind of lives they lead. And Marx had a very crude take on the relationship between ideology and economics. For him, economics is the motor of everything. And that where you are in the economic map or in the economic ladder will determine what you think about that. And since then, we've moved away from that. We've looked at how there's much more complex relationship between thought and action, between ideology and material practice, what you're actually doing every day. That it's hard to quite figure out that one determines the other. There's a lot of going back and forth between them. So it's not as easy as that. As a result, Marx has thought of as being very materialist, because he's grounded in the economics and the making of living focus. So from production theory, well, I'll spend the last few minutes talking about consumption theory, the last in our tripartite equation. And this is a more recent upload, not because Vaclav Malinovsky is talking about new focus. Have you thought about this too? Malinovsky was one of these early anthropologists we've already mentioned in the course, who worked in the Trobriand Islands, in Melanesia. And he thought that consumption occurred to fulfill certain, primarily biological needs. That, you know, you consume foods because you need food. I mean, that you create houses simply because you need shelter. And that's the main emphasis on consumption. Simply the fulfillment of needs. And taken to this extreme form, that can be seen as a form of biological determinism, that what our bodies need therefore determines what our culture will produce for us, or what we do. And so that's it, the argument in its extreme form. It's flawed because it reduces the complexity of human thought and action to one single factor, that if it was just biology, then people living in the same environment or having access to the same kinds of foods would all be doing the same thing, because their biology sort of determines that. And we know that's not true. We know that in any given environment, a community may find one plant edible, meanwhile another community might find that plant poisonous, as far as they're concerned. We eat different things, we do different things, we construct different forms of shelter. All these things are, there's too much diversity in how we go about fulfilling those needs, that you cannot anymore talk about simply consumption is the fulfillment of biological needs. The book then goes on to talk about cultural ecology. It says how other people came and started theorizing consumption in terms of constraints given in the environment. That you create certain houses, you pursue certain economic strategies because you're limited, given your environment, on what those strategies are. So cultural ecology is not necessarily the proponent of that, but it examines the relationship between people and their environment. And the most extreme form of it assumes that consumption occurs only in direct relation to what the constraints are of the environment. But as I showed you in the map of Kenya, you have a very similar environment and very different ways of approaching how to live within that same environment. So environment also, just like biology, cannot be the only factor. There's got to be other things contributing to it. So cultural diversity is not accounted for in either of these, the extreme forms of these two interpretations. And there are less extreme forms, and so I don't need to throw out the baby with the bathwater. But so how do we take into effect in culture? Culture defines the needs of its people and shapes their strategies for responding to those needs. It gives meaning to life and how one goes about making life in the terminology of Bradford Williams again. It's not just about making a living. If it was just that, then we could talk about, you know, materialist reductionism or biological reductionism or the environmental reductionism. But it's more than that. Making a living is just one part of what we do as humans. We are involved in this endeavor to make lives for ourselves. And life is much more than simply the eating and the sleeping and the doing that we need for our basic needs. So how is it culture then helps us to understand what else goes into making a living that makes us live lives that we find meaningful and with purpose? The book talks about food prohibitions as different ways that culture intervenes in the consumption process. That, for instance, it talks about how pork is an abominable food in terms of Islamic and Jewish communities, and why is that so? You know, people are living, it's the same meat for everybody. It's edible by some standards, but not at all edible by others. How is that? That's an example of culture intervening and bringing a different meaning to food. Food is not simply food. Food means who you are. It's a marker of identity. If you don't eat pork, that identifies you as a particular type of person. If you do eat pork, that identifies you as a particular type of person. So it's not simply food for the fulfillment of our bodily needs. Another example would be money. Money we think of as a standard value, reducible to a single price, a single value all over the world, just by whatever type of money you're dealing with. But anthropological studies of the uses of money also show that money takes on different connotations and different meanings. So that in East Africa, among the Luo community in Uganda, where David Parkin has done research, there's money, there's bitter money, which is bad money, and good money. And it depends on which crop it came from. If you grow corn and you derive a profit from that, well, then that's good money. And you can use that money to pay for your daughter's wedding or to pay for your funerals. That's good money that can be generating more life in terms of your kin obligations. But if you're growing tobacco or any of a variety of other crops that are not thought of as highly desirable, and it brings in a profit, you cannot then channel that money into things related to the regeneration of your family. It's seen as somehow it's going to hurt your family. It's bad money. It's tainted. So the money's the same. And it's the same money, but it has different meanings according to where it came from. So again, it's an example of culture intervening and bringing meaning to things. And we're not so far off of that. We have the idea of money laundering, right? That's taking money that came out of bad sources and having to be washed somehow and made good again so that it can be clean money. So it's not a totally foreign concept from us. Now, I just have one more thing to end with, and that's this question about making a living versus making life in America. A few days ago, there was this article in the New York Times about a new disease or syndrome that's particularly bad in the Silicon Valley area, but it's also bad States. It's called sudden wealth syndrome. It's also called affluenza. And what you do when you suddenly are wealthy behind your wildest imaginations and all the problems that it has. The article had these families that are having to do these support groups and stuff. And they talk about how the kids are interviewed. And if you're middle class, that's the lowest of the low. Man, if you only get one trip to Hawaii per year, oh, you've got to the absolute bottom of the social ladder. And they talk about these kids, you know, it's just totally normal. Daddy has a helicopter, plus an airplane, plus this, plus that. And all the stresses that comes with that. So if making a living is what these people are clearly excellent at, but what these articles seem to suggest is that they're not terribly good at making life, but they're having all these problems attached to the making of a living. So I leave you with that. Think about the difference between making a living and making